3 tracks the shaping of the story. Chapter 4 is one of the most interesting in the book. It's why MGM decided to make the film in the first place, and it's a fascinating chapter. One of the things that is distinguished in 2001 is that it's one of those rarities, an operatic film. The only others I can think of off the top of my head are Once Upon a Time in the West and possibly Solaris. But in an operatic film, you take a very simple story and give it a huge vocal, actorial, visual presentation and treatment. And at the end of that experience, when you reflect back, you think, that story's actually kind of simple, but then you realize it's not simple. It's actually an extremely complicated thesis and approach. So that is Peter Kramer's 2001 A Space Odyssey from the British Film Institute Film Classics series. That's it for Film at 11 here on KABU. Enjoy Halloween tomorrow and keep watching the screens.
KABU's web and new media coordinator. KABU's in the last week of our fall membership drive. We're getting close to our $80,000 goal, which we need to reach by October 31st. We need your help to get there. Community radio is essential in times of crisis because it's one of the few places you can get real, unfiltered news, information, and music from right here in your community without algorithms, advertising, or search engine optimization. Please go to KABU.fm and click Donate. Or click on the banner on the KABU app to support KABU with your one-time or monthly contribution. Thank you, KABU members. You make this station happen.
KABU Community Radio encourages all our listeners, whatever your political affiliation, to vote. October 27th is the last day to safely mail in your ballot. The last day to drop off your ballot at a Dropbox site is November 3rd by 8 p.m. If you have any difficulties getting to a ballot Dropbox, poll workers are providing ballot pickups. These resources and more information on voting can be found at kabu.fm/election resources.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely existed outside of the national spotlight.
Downtown Portland cleared out after 5 p.m. and city buses rode through quiet streets populated by hobos, punks, drunks, drug dealers, and street kids. Some of these kids were targeted by white nationalists and became neo-Nazi skinheads.
Late one night in 1988, Mulugeta Sarah was beaten with a baseball bat and left for dead.
Three white kids who killed Sarah weren't outside agitators, but members of Eastside White Pride, a neo-Nazi street gang.
By the mid-90s, racist skinheads had disappeared from the streets of Portland. How did this happen?
It Did Happen Here is a documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together with the diversity of tactics to drive white supremacist street gangs out of Portland.
The first episode will be released November 13th, the 32nd anniversary of the murder of Mulugeta Sarah.
Stay tuned.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On our program today, we'll explore educational institutions and materials. First, Deborah Menkart, Executive Director of Teaching for Change, will join us to discuss a new campaign against a couple of kids' books published by Scholastic about Donald Trump. Menkart will explain why many Americans are up in arms about the books that paint a rosy picture of the most dangerous president in memory. Then author Ellen Moore will discuss her book called Grateful Nation, Student Veterans and the Rise of the Military-Friendly Campus. Stay tuned. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The school textbook publishing giant Scholastic is under fire for its children's books about President Donald Trump. Scholastic publishes a large number of books that are in wide use throughout American schools and libraries. And while the corporation has gotten into trouble before, this new scandal has really irked many Americans over the rosy picture that the kids' books paint about Trump. The books in question are both written by the same author, Joanne Mattern, one for older kids as part of the A True Book series, the other one for younger kids as part of the Rookie Biography series. While the books were published last year, they have received renewed scrutiny recently after a social media backlash. The organization Teaching for Change has just reviewed them. Many are using the hashtag StepUpScholastic to call the company out on its portrayal of a dangerous president as an utterly normal. My guest is Deborah Menkart, Executive Director of Teaching for Change. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So first, before we get to what is so problematic about these books, how widespread is Scholastic? For anybody who has kids, you probably have several of their books in your kids' library, right?
Yes, in fact, it's considered to be the most trusted name in children's books. There's probably not an elementary school teacher out there who's not been involved in a book fair, a Scholastic book fair. So it's not an easy choice to say, I'm going to give up Scholastic and look for other titles. They're pervasive.
So this is basically a normal thing for them to publish a book about a new president. When a new president comes into office, they publish, they sort of add to their series, and people, you know, and the schools will provide them for kids. Kids can read about their new president. So why is it problematic that they did this for Donald Trump? He is, after all, the 45th president of the U.S.
Yes, and they, I should point out, they haven't done them for all the presidents, but yes, it is important for schools, for elementary schools, particularly in their school library, to have a children's book about the president. These are actually normally considered library books. They're not as widely available in individual classrooms. What's problematic for us about this one is that it's about his campaign, and it gives young children the appearance that he won based on his business prowess and his TV stardom. There is not one reference to the comments he made and the promises he made during his campaign, which wreaked fear in the hearts of many and contributed largely to his victory. Mm-hmm. So it claims to be nonfiction, and yet it's far from that.
Well, interestingly enough, the book for slightly older kids, part of the A True Book series, one of the first pages in that book is emblazoned with the title, Find the Truth. Everything you're about to read is true, except for one of the sentences on this page. And then it, you know, has one of these things. So it's interesting when you're talking about truth. Now, the books do portray Trump as this maverick, if you will, and say that he became, they almost sort of romanticize the fact that he went from a businessman to running for office. And is that problematic? You know, he certainly did run a business, but do the books sort of erroneously point out that his businesses were very successful, therefore he might make a good president?
They give the impression, one, that they glorify his businesses and his business prowess without any reference to the employees, the land that was destroyed to create those businesses, or the shady business deals that have been part of the backbone of his career. But more importantly, that's not why he got elected. I think if you look at the polls and the people who supported him, they wouldn't have supported any business leader. They supported him because of the comments and the promises he made. And those are absent from the book. So young children, as young as first and second grade, are very aware of what those promises were and what those threats were, in many cases, to their own lives. And yet those are absent from the book, which could cause real confusion for children as to why their own reality and their concerns are left out.
I want to read from page 35 of this book, this is a true book about Donald Trump. It said, many people were shocked at the idea of Trump as president. He had no political experience. He had never held a public office or taken part in political activities. For this reason, some people thought he was not qualified to be president. Others loved the idea of an outsider coming in to shake up the way the government was run. Some supporters felt ignored or neglected by the government. They believed Trump would look out for them. So this seems to at least legitimize this idea that Trump came in to give voice to millions of voiceless Americans.
Yes, although it does not say anything about who the people are that felt voice, or any issue when you look through this book that's for the older children, which Scholastic actually came out with a statement. You know, there's been a campaign, there's been more than 800 letters written of concern and complaint from teachers and parents, librarians all over the country. And Scholastic came out with a statement saying that, controversial issues, I could actually look at their exact language, but they said that, they actually even said, most teachers and librarians we serve would agree that discussing controversial aspects of any public figure's life isn't appropriate for our youngest readers. Well, their youngest readers, in this case, are supposed to be first and second grade, who, as we know, are constantly asking why and are very well aware of what's going on in the world. But then Scholastic goes on to claim that actually the book for the older readers, that they do argue are ready to deal with those tougher topics, that there the book is more honest and more informative. Mm-hmm. But we would argue that it's not, that the statement that you just read really could be written about every president's candidacy throughout U.S. history. There was always some people who supported the president and some who didn't, some who felt represented by the government and some who didn't. The entire book features people of color on one page, and that one page has them protesting and surrounded by police. There is, the word racism is not used once. So again, it's a surreal reality where this person got elected on an explicitly racist platform, and yet the word racism or who he was demeaning throughout his candidacy is not referenced.
Well, they use the words discriminate and prejudicial. There's one page, and one page alone in the A True Book version of this book about Trump, entitled Campaign Statements, where at the very bottom of that page, you see an image of some of the protests. And this is what that page says. Trump made several statements during his campaign that were concerning to some people. For example, he promised to build a wall between the United States and Mexico to keep out illegal immigrants. It's kind of sad that it uses the term illegal immigrants. Opponents argued that the cost and terrain made the building the wall challenging. Others worried that Trump would discriminate against Muslims in his fight against terrorism. Some of Trump's critics felt he did not speak out against prejudicial people and groups strongly enough. That is it, Deborah. That was the extent of them tackling these controversies, quote unquote controversies for older children. Interestingly enough, I found that there was literally no mention whatsoever about Trump's denigrating comments about women. This is very clear and became an issue before the election. Nothing at all.
Right. Nothing at all about women. Nothing about his extremely denigrating comments about Mexican Americans, African Americans, Muslims, you know, other than the one reference, but even that's not quoting him that you just read. People who are disabled, POWs. I mean, it's just.
Right, he mocked a disabled reporter.
Right. He questioned the right of the judge to who was Mexican American, to hear his case. And then we know he said much worse things about Mexican American or Mexican immigrants. None of that. And so it's as if. Right. Some people were troubled, not the fact that his election led to some of the largest demonstrations this country has seen.
Among the things that they discuss in this book, that the author discusses in this book, earlier in the book about Trump's business record in New York is a page about Woman Rink. By 1980, the beloved woman ice skating rink in New York City Central Park was falling apart. It was closed, etc. Trump offered to rebuild Woman at no cost to the city. This rink reopened less than 6 months later. Trump got a lot of good publicity, and New Yorkers once again had a Central Park skating rink to enjoy. This page makes it sound like Trump swooped in and did something wonderful for the people of New York. Makes literally no mention at all about Trump's role in his racist attacks against the Central Park Five, right?
I agree. Yeah, that we actually pointed out, we published a review of, as you mentioned, of both books, and with that one we say to mention the skating rink and not mention the fact that when he had no political elected role, that he took it upon himself to take out ads in the four major New York papers against calling really for the death penalty against the Central Park Five, who were, as we all know, later proved to be innocent, assumed to be innocent by many at the time, and were teenagers. He was calling for the death penalty of children. There's so many, and then he was responsible for the whole birther movement. So many examples.
The accusation that President Obama was not born in the United States. That's right. Trump continued to harp on that even during his campaign.
Right. And so we know that all of those racist claims contributed to, through, you know, for decades, let alone during his candidacy, contributed to his popularity and support. And so to insinuate that he was elected because of his even if we considered him a good businessman, which I think that also should be called into question given his practices, this really celebrates vulture capitalism of that it doesn't matter what you do to become rich, it's okay, and look, you get to be president. But that isn't why he got elected. We can think of a lot of wealthy millionaires at this time, and if they ran for election, would not be elected based on that. It was his campaign statements that he made over and quite proudly. I mean, what they're hiding, what Scholastic is hiding, are statements that Trump had no qualms about making and continues to defend. And so they've really created this campaign package for him. There's even the book for older children has a line, the true book. It says, big, large font, Trump has never smoked, drunk alcohol, or taken drugs. Well, for one thing, how do they know?
By the way, that he pretty much forged his own doctor's report about his health.
right. But so it's a concern, not just in this book about Trump, but it's a concern that a major, we're talking about a major, as you said, as you talked about earlier, the widespread pervasiveness of Scholastic throughout our schools, that they're normalizing hate, and they're causing young people to think that if someone is that hateful, if they're elected, then we need to ignore all that and just revere and respect them. A number of, we've been attacked on Fox and Friends and Breitbart and by Fox News. They've said that we don't want a book by Trump in the schools, and that's not what we're arguing. We're not arguing for censorship. We're arguing that young people deserve the truth, and they deserve the truth in age-appropriate ways. We would not want the first and second grade book to actually repeat most of what he says. It would not be age-appropriate language. But it does need to be communicated that his platform was based on saying very demeaning things about all the people that we just listed.
The book aimed at younger kids, part of the Rookie Biography series, is also deeply, deeply problematic. And they're written by the same person, Joanne Mattern, so it's not surprising that they basically follow the same theme. And I'll just sort of read the summary of Donald Trump from the first page, which reflects what these books portray. Donald Trump is a famous entrepreneur. He's also a television personality. In 2015, Trump surprised many people when he decided to run for president. In November 2016, he won the election. Donald Trump became the 45th president of the United States. That's basically it, right? He was a businessman. He was a reality TV star. He made the surprise decision to run for president. He won. End of story. Walk away. But this book is kind of bizarre in that there's a poem about Donald Trump in the book for, you know, very, very little children. I just want to read this poem as well. I'm trying to find it here in our, here it is, a poem about Donald Trump. His buildings reached into the sky, his businesses just grew and grew. Then Trump became our president. People wanted something new. I thought this was the most vomit-worthy section of both these books, Deborah.
Yeah, and I think that poem really summarizes the tone and the level of information available in both books. So we've been getting a lot of the letters that have been written to Scholastic include suggestions for alternatives for that poem that are quite witty. And I think it's a good assignment for young people, because what we're hearing from a lot of teachers of young children is that they're really concerned that if their students came across this book, that their lives that have already been threatened would then also be invalidated, and that the children would feel, even more concerned that their own reality was not being, in truth, as they know it, is not being reflected in this supposedly nonfiction book. And I should point out that this is a concern we have not just about these two books about Trump. These don't come out of, these are not anomalies, that textbooks, the media, children's books for way too many years have created a rosy picture, have elevated political leaders regardless of their policies and practices. And that's, we coordinate with Rethinking Schools something called the Zen Education Project, and there our focus is to teach outside the textbook, because really we need to look outside the textbook for the resources, the people's history, the true stories, the stories that reflect the lives of our children and help them make informed decisions moving forward. We're also part of a collaborative called the See What We See Network, where teachers, librarians, early childhood educators look at children's literature and fight for not just diversity in children's literature, but for also for truth and honesty, so that there are books that reflect the real experiences of the majority of people in the world.
Tell us a little bit about the hashtag Step Up Scholastic campaign. I understand there's also a petition to Scholastic. What are some of the ways, if people have been outraged by what we've been discussing and want to get in touch with Scholastic, what are some of the ways they can take action?
Yeah, well, if it's okay, I'll give a little bit of background on that. This is actually not the first time that there's been a campaign to hold Scholastic accountable. And I should also point out, Scholastic's not the only publisher that needs to rethink how they produce children's books. But this one, because of how widely they're used in the schools and how egregious this particular pair of books are, we're focusing on. But it was actually about four or five years ago that Scholastic had a partnership with the American Coal Foundation. And the American Coal Foundation was paying for...
The American Coal Foundation. Wow, yes. Okay. So a fossil fuel company, industry group, yeah.
Yes, because they... Scholastic has a great reputation and it sells that reputation. It's a brand that they sell. And so that through that partnership, they were distributing a curriculum to fourth grade classrooms across the country that talked about clean coal and did not make any attempt to be balanced to say, but on the other hand, there are these environmental concerns. It was a commercial for the coal company, just like these children's books are a commercial for Trump, and not just Trump, but his administration and his policies. So thankfully, it was actually in this case, it was Rethinking Schools got a hold of that. They partnered with the Center for Commercial Free Childhood and a lot of environmental groups. A story was released in the New York Times, and Scholastic quickly had to publish a statement that they were withdrawing from that partnership. Fast forward a couple of years, 2 years ago, they released a children's book called A Birthday Cake for George Washington, all about how the Hercules, who was a real person who was enslaved to the Washington family, this was a children's picture book, and it said that his biggest problem that he had was that he had run out of sugar to bake George Washington's cake. And so the whole story becomes how he comes up with a substitute for sugar. He finds honey, and so he's so happy to serve his master. And the back page is a picture of him arm in arm with George, Hercules and George, living happily ever after.
Wow.
Of course, the reality is that Hercules managed to escape from the Washingtons, had to leave his daughter behind. I mean, it's a tragic story, as many, as all stories of people who are enslaved are, but that was left out of the book. And again, we organized with other groups, a number of other groups, organized a campaign. And Scholastic for 4 days defended that book very heavily and argued that it was humanizing people who are enslaved. That is when there was a colleague of ours, Leslie Mack with the National Ferguson Response Network, came up with the hashtag Slavery with a Smile. And the media picked up on it, the progressive media, and finally Scholastic had to recall the book. They managed to put a twist on it. They had learned from the Cole story not, to get their own foot forward, and they recalled the book, but they immediately put out a press release claiming that it was because of their own high standards and totally ignored the whole organizing campaign by librarians, by early childhood teachers. And erase that because they have an incredible communications sort of operation. And in fact, the author came out later and referred to us as an online lynch mob.
Wow.
But thankfully, they did recall the book. And it was after that that a number of the people involved in that campaign said that it's not enough for them to recall a book. We do need to demand accountability for them to produce books that do represent the diversity and the real experiences of children in schools. And looking at the catalog that they have for these school fairs and that they give out to kids every month, the catalogs looked as white as the Oscars did a few years ago.
Hmm.
So we started the campaign then, Step Up Scholastic, and children, in that case it was largely children across the country, would look at the catalogs and write letters and ask why there were not children that looked like them featured in their stories. So that campaign has gone on for about the last year and a half and has garnered hundreds of letters, they have issued as a result. Now they have some diverse catalogs. So they've partnered with, I think, We Need Diverse Books, and they do have a couple of diverse catalogs.
And these sorts of campaigns work. I mean,
yes.
Ultimately, yep. Scholastic relies on the acceptance of parents and teachers and children and ordinary Americans of their material. And if we demand higher standards, they have to deliver or risk ruining their reputation or losing their business. I sort of missed reading this other part. I want to just go back to what started our whole conversation, which is these biographies of Trump for kids by Scholastic. The rookie biography for first and second graders described the election, that caused such mass collective anxiety in the country. This is how Scholastic described the election. On November 8th, 2016, Americans voted for president. The race was close, but Trump won. Many people were happy. They looked forward to a brand new government. They hoped for a stronger country. It continues a couple of pages later. Donald Trump inspired his supporters to try something new. He promised them a better future. Millions of Americans are counting on him to help improve their lives. And that's it. I mean, then if we read the news every single day since his election and since he was inaugurated, there's been, you know, such mass anger, anxiety, despair, depression, people's lives on the line, people literally having their lives being risked and violence being fomented, none of which is reflected, or even a hint of it reflected in this. And so this book basically presenting this absolutely normal seeming president. And you couldn't retort to it and say, well, you wouldn't want a book highlighting all the controversies about Barack Obama. Of course, Barack Obama and probably none of the presidents before him ever had these sorts of this level of controversy behind them, right?
Well, actually, it is a problem that all the books about presidents, you know, going back to when you look at the books about, you know, the first 12 presidents, actually not all first 12, but 12 of our U.S. presidents have owned and sold people, have been involved in human trafficking. That should be in children's books. That
right.
shouldn't be hidden.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's true, the rookie book about Barack Obama's campaign, because that's been some of what the right-wing response has been. Well, you didn't critique that one. Well, actually, the book about his campaign talks about him being a community organizer, talks about his skills when he was in law school. You know, that's true. And those were things that are legitimate to get elected on. If it was a children's book about his presidency and it did not mention his responsibility in drone attacks, his high level of deportations, that would be a problem to us too, and we would call it out.
Right.
But I think that this book, as you said, and it's also a problem when they put, as the section you just read, that much power in the hands of any one person to deliver, to make this a better country or better world. It really robs the role of quote-unquote ordinary people of a democracy, that we're all responsible for making this a better country. So it puts it as if, you know, he's either a king that we can revere, or if we don't agree with this book, we can disagree and not revere him. But it's putting all power in his hands, which it should not. You know, we should have been electing a president, not a king.
Interestingly enough, on the same page as the poem about Donald Trump is a set of three pieces of advice, presumably to children, but really perhaps this should be aimed at Donald Trump. You can be president, it says. Learn how government works. Listen to other people and learn to share ideas for how to solve problems. Say what you believe in and work to make your dreams come true. I suppose he is fulfilling that last part. Say what you believe in and work to make your dreams come true, but not the first two.
Yeah, and make his own dreams and his own family dreams, you know, wealthy dreams. It's I think the other issue that, you know, Scholastic has in their statement said that it was not fair to critique the book because it was about his campaign, not his presidency. But our critique was focused on the campaign. Mm-hmm. And we know that there were enough things said during his campaign that it led to the largest protests we've seen, because it was very clear what direction the presidency was going to take. So I think it was absolutely fair to critique the book about the campaign. Those promises, you know, or threats were how he got elected. And then I think, as you said, you know, it's also as if not that people are actually finding that he's delivering. I mean, even when we see the protests now of teachers in many states that elected Trump, that it's you know, that promise, it was pretty predictable that he wouldn't be able to deliver, that it wasn't a promise.
Deborah, where can people find out more about your organization, Teaching for Change, and the review of the Scholastic books?
Yeah. So our primary website is teachingforchange.org. We also have a social justice books website where we have not just the critique, but also reviews and recommendations and book lists for many books that we do recommend that people share, order, read, get from your local library, from an independent bookstore, and then many other reviews from the See What We See network. So that's at sojustbooks.org, sojustbooks.org. But you can find all of that at Teaching for Change. And we are still collecting letters. As you said earlier, letters do have an impact. Scholastic does worry about its the marketability of its brand, of its reputation. And so if people continue to write letters, we might get an even better response than the one that they issued last week, which was a weak defense and really insulting to teachers, librarians in its argument that young children cannot deal with controversial issues.
That's teachingforchange.org. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for focusing on this story.
My guest has been Deborah Menkart, Executive Director of Teaching for Change. We've been discussing Scholastic's books for kids about Donald Trump's campaign and how he won his presidency. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Military recruiters often tout the accessibility of a college education as one of the biggest reasons why a young person might want to enroll in the Army or Navy. But how many veterans of the U.S. military actually take advantage of the GI Bill's educational perk and do so successfully? In a new book, author Ellen Moore explores the experiences of college students who are military vets of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and how they transition to civilian campus life. She also examines the way in which vets on campus impact anti-war activism and how programs intended to support veterans often overlap with a blanket support of militarism, leading to a suppression of debate. Ellen Moore is a fellow at the Slow Science Institute and a visiting scholar at the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues at University of California. She works as a social worker for recent immigrants at La Clinica de la Raza in Oakland, California. And she joins me to discuss her new book, Grateful Nation, Student Veterans and the Rise of the Military-Friendly Campus. Welcome to the program, Ellen.
Thank you.
So how did you conduct the research for this book? I'm assuming since you are on campus, you have taught courses at in San Francisco on college campuses, that you have interacted with returning vets attempting to resume civilian life and take advantage of that educational perk that I mentioned.
Yes, I have. I started this research, though, to find out. I was teaching as a graduate student on campuses, and I started the research to find out what the situation was for veterans. So I started it as actually my dissertation research. And the way I did it was I visited many campuses, but I mostly concentrated on two campuses. This is an ethnographic project. So I studied vets' experience at one urban public university, a sort of a top-tier university, and then at a rural community college in Central California.
And let's talk about what it was that you found. First of all, what is the sort of approach that veterans tend to take at colleges in terms of what they want to achieve? Not all veterans, you know, have lost limbs or faced very serious combat. I'm assuming there's a big variety of experiences. I'm assuming some may be experiencing some severe PTSD and others not so much.
Yes, I think that's a really good point, that the experience of veterans is extremely diverse, I mean, very varied. And in fact, people join the military for different reasons. I was looking at a subset of the people that joined the military, and these were people that really were interested in a college education and basically signed up to go to war to go to college. I mean, that's what, that was ultimately the deal. That's not why they did it. They didn't want to go to war, but they did want to go to college. For the most part, they didn't want to.
So these were people who joined the military with the intention of wanting to return and go to college because it might not have been accessible for them unless they went into the military in the first place?
Yes, it wasn't. I didn't exclude others that joined for other reasons, but that was, by and large, a lot of people were interested in going to college at least, and many didn't have the resources to do it. But for whatever the varied reasons that they joined, once they were in college, what I found interesting was that we were all told that colleges are, that veterans are having a difficult time in college because college, civilian colleges have an anti-military bias, which was something that I didn't see. I hadn't seen in my experience prior, and I didn't see throughout the course of my research, but I thought it was curious that that sort of idea kept coming up, that veterans might be having a hard time in college because civilians on college campuses were in effect driving them away.
It sort of reminds me of that myth that returning Vietnam veterans to the United States were spat upon by anti-war activists and were vilified even after they had sacrificed so much. And you're saying that this this might also be a myth, that returning Afghanistan and Iraq war vets being shunned by non-military college students is a bit of a myth.
Exactly. No, it is exactly a myth. And what I found is that it's a myth, with the foundational myth being the Vietnam vets myth. I mean, it's built on this idea that we as a collective civilian population mistreated the Vietnam veterans on campuses. And so we as collective civilians today owe it to the Afghanistan and Iraq war veterans to treat them exceptionally well and to honor them and to venerate their service on campuses. Mm-hmm. So it not only is a similar myth, but it's a myth based on the myth of mm-hmm. Vietnam.
So the there are two separate issues, and you take them both on because they're often conflated on college campuses. One is that veterans who return from the U.S. military, they're ordinary people who are often in circumstances that are not ideal. They, you know, might be arising from low-income families or communities. They've come back and they need support, and they may or may not, you know, they may have a variety of opinions on the wars they served in. So most Americans agree that it's important for us to support veterans. Then there's the issue of glorifying war and glorifying the reasons these students or these young people were sent to war in the first place and celebrating militarism. How do college campuses often conflate the two to the detriment of both vets and non-veteran students?
That's a great question. And I think that the way that they're conflated, it's very subtle. I mean, it starts out with the heartfelt assumption that many civilians have. I would say, if not most, many civilians have, that people have been sent to war and they deserve to feel safe and they deserve to feel welcomed back. I think that is a pretty widespread opinion. But to take that idea, to couple it with, to suture it to an idea or a story that campuses are already anti-military or have a bias, creates the need. It creates a manufactured problem of the anti-military campus, so that extra effort has to be put into ensuring that civilian campuses are military friendly, which is actually a status that different universities and colleges vie for, is the military friendly status. It's actually a thing that is a designation that colleges can apply for and have bestowed on them. So with this designation of a military-friendly campus, everybody's trying to sort of compete as to who can be the most welcoming to veterans. But the problem with that is not that veterans get a good education. There's no problem in that. The problem, as I see it, is that when support for veterans becomes conflated with a silence about the wars. For example, I read in some literature, some what's called the best practice literature about treating veterans on campus, treating them well. Part of that literature says that admonishes professors and faculty members not to talk about the wars in their classes because somebody might say something offensive to veterans, meaning that if somebody says something against U.S. policy or the current wars, that that might offend some veterans that are in class.
So veterans are being treated as symbols of U.S. militarism. Therefore, if you criticize U.S. militarism, you're criticizing the veterans as actual people. But in practical terms, is that really true? How have veterans reacted to any anti-war activism they might see on campus, or anti-war, or just even questioning of militarism in classes?
Well, absolutely. In fact, many veterans arrive on college campuses specifically wanting to question their experience, wanting to understand their experience in war, which, by the way, many, many veterans have extremely conflicted feelings about what they did. So the assumption that all veterans positively identify with their military experience is a false assumption, and it's detrimental to veterans who don't fit into that narrative. And so many come and decide to study things like Middle Eastern studies because they want to engage in these debates. They want to understand their experience. They want to make sense out of their experience. And so many told me that they came to college campuses and they were expecting discussions, and they basically said, "What's going on here? Why is nobody talking about the wars? Why is nobody mentioning this?" And so there's this sort of gift of the Magi idea that you're supposed to help the veterans by not talking about the wars. And the veterans are saying, "Why is nobody talking about the wars? I wanna find out why."
It's a sort of patronizing attitude that college campuses have been told they need to adopt in order to make veterans feel welcoming. But what it has done is stifle debate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so, which then in turn alienates veterans even more so.
Right, doesn't actually help the very people that need the help. Veterans have often been on the forefront of anti-war activism on and off campus. Not all veterans are anti-war, obviously. Not all are supportive of war either. But how have veterans found their anti-war voices on campus? Is that something that, because campuses are supposed to be, college campuses are supposed to be places where you engage in healthy debate and question things.
Absolutely. I mean, Sonali, that was one of the curious things that I found. I didn't go into this looking for anti-war activism on campuses, but in the course of my research, I noticed, an absence of that. And I think my theory is that in part that's because people are so cautious to do what they think they should do, which is not talk about the wars so as to prevent potential offense to veterans. It was curious to me that college campuses today are not centers for activism against the wars. In fact, it's largely, most campuses that I saw were largely silent on this issue. What I found was that veterans that wanted to speak up against and be organized against the wars generally found spaces off campus.
Wow.
That's different from previous times. And so Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is now what's known as About Face, did not have chapters in the campuses that I was at. It seems like, and I can't speak for all of their chapters, but it did seem like off-campus organizing was much more powerful than on-campus.
Now, what about military recruitment on campus and how the U.S. military itself has a presence on many campuses? How does that impact campus life for students in general, but also vets?
Well, again, if somebody's being recruited on campus, on a college campus, that generally means they're being recruited for ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps. The people that are sort of on the enlist at the lowest levels or at the beginning levels generally tend to not be enlisted through college.
Right, they're in high school.
Exactly. That's where the recruitment goes, and college is held out as the carrot in that negotiation that you can't. If you do this. So on campuses, it varies. I mean, there's some campuses that are deeply aligned and overtly aligned with military projects. Certainly in California, there's private schools that are deeply embedded in the military project, and I would say that are obvious. But throughout the public education system and the private education system, military research funding, military priorities are embedded in not obvious ways. So I think my research, looking at common sense and militarization of common sense, is more in the non-obvious spaces. There's certainly funding from the Department of Defense, DARPA funding, for technologies around militaries and fighting wars and surveillance. And from drone technology to artificial limb technology, there's robotics, facial recognition technology. It's all very much a part of the current contemporary university.
Right.
And what I was interested in is how even universities that are known for historic opposition to previous wars and the Vietnam War in particular, how they become sort of more than benign welcoming, more a sort of self-silencing, the self-silencing mechanisms that happen in the names of not offending veterans.
And do you think that this has been a direct result of these efforts by forces outside campuses to force campuses to conform to this idea of supporting veterans, clearly misguided idea of supporting veterans?
I do. I think that it's not an accident. I think it's not an accident, and we can look back to what's called the first Gulf War, what the military calls Operation Desert Storm, where there was in the first Bush administration, where there was definitely this idea that we can't repeat the problems that we had in Vietnam. So we have to preemptively have this narrative of supporting our military and supporting our veterans, especially on college campuses. So I think college campuses were targeted at that time to sort of formulate this discourse to make sure that there was not campus activism.
And so now we've seen that these methods have proven largely successful. Well, if killing debate about wars on campus isn't actually helping the people it's supposed to help, which is veterans, what does help them? I imagine for veterans returning to transition into civilian life, it is difficult in general, but to start an educational career on a college campus so different from where they might have spent the last several years of their life might be even more complicated. What do they find support in?
Okay, I think that's a great question. I think some things that absolutely help are listening to them. I mean, it seems very basic, but we know that just listening to people's experience and finding out what it is that they're looking for helps. Now, the veteran population, although many veterans, war veterans, have had specific experiences that can affect life afterwards, traumatic experiences, the training that recruits go through is very regimented and very specific. You know, people are trained to fight in wars and people are trained to follow orders in a particular way. So the kind of military training I found really transferred over into these vets on college campuses, that if you are trained specifically not to question authority, not to question conventional wisdom, if you're trained to react reflexively rather than think about things a lot before you take an action, these kind of lessons are very much embodied in the veterans. And it's boot camp. Anybody will tell you the boot camp is a very kind of traumatizing experience, or the lessons of boot camp can endure. So there was a disconnection when people came back to civilian life and sort of reacted in sort of military inculcated ways in situations where the opposite was expected. So that was one thing that I did notice. But in general, people that come to university that maybe don't come from a college prep background, and many of the recruits in the current wars are not coming from, you know, they didn't choose necessarily to join the military from an array of college prep options. So there is that what we have found, that people that are entering into a university experience, especially as sort of a research university experience, need support. And this goes for any student that is coming from a non-college prep background. This comes from first-generation students, right. This comes from immigrant students, it comes from anybody that comes from a working-class background and wasn't prepared from birth to go to university. So we know what helps. We know that mentoring helps, we know that tutoring helps, we know that, you know, educational research is robust in this. How do you help people that have
right?
Not
and then it's
been
not trained? It's not that complicated. It sounds like
it's not complicated at all.
Are there specific issues facing female vets who return to campuses? We know that our female vets have their own struggles in the military, and we know that women have their own struggles on campus. Sexual violence is hugely prevalent in the military, as it is on campuses. Do women face any extra challenges when they try to transition from the military to campuses?
Well, in general, with the women that I spoke with, coming to a university, civilian university campus or college campus, was in many ways freeing, because the sort of constraints that they felt as women in the military, as transgressors, just for being female. I mean, women are transgressors in a military milieu, because it is designed for men. There is what I call military misogyny that is imbued in everything, from military training to wars. So in many ways, it's a freeing experience. What I did find is that one of the factors that happens for vets coming to colleges is that there tends to be veterans clubs, which can be a good thing. So veterans join together on colleges and they support each other to get through this. However, most of the veterans clubs are sort of built on this sort of military identity that tends to be male dominated. So the vets clubs tended to be male dominated. And so many of the female vets or the women vets sort of decide, you know, later for that was not going to help them. So I think that the challenges were less with and interfacing with civilian college cultures, and were more with the sort of recreated military structures in the veterans clubs on campuses. Mm.
Are there racial and immigration related issues as well that vets struggle with? We know that our military has disproportionate representation from youth of color. There are kids with immigrant backgrounds that go into the military, you know, come from immigrant families. So do they also face sort of other struggles?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, what we find is in urban areas, particularly, it tends to be more youth of color that join. In the rural areas, specifically the rural southern areas of the United States, the recruitment tends to be more white, working class, or poor. But in the urban areas, absolutely. And my experience was that veterans of color definitely, you know, in some ways, they were sort of caught between two worlds, because coming to the university, there was a lot more recognition and well, I won't say there's less racism. I won't say that. I will say that it has different manifestations, but there was more room to talk about. There was more room for critique. There was more room to critique the established norms. And so in that sense, it was freeing for many of the vets of color. At the same time, if one has a military identity that for good or bad or whatever the consequence of that is, people do have identities that are formed that they feel certain affinities or certain bonds with their colleagues, comrades from the military. So they're still caught in that the nexus of sort of racialized discourses from all sides. Mm-hmm. But what I found was that people in general, people of color, vets of color, were welcoming the opportunity to talk about these things, to talk about the contradictions, rather than either front, you know, play along with them or just go along with the dominant discourse of the military, which is a whiteness discourse. Male whiteness discourse.
And finally, Ellen, in our current political atmosphere, where we have been told we mustn't question the military and mustn't question militarism because it's a massive slap in the face to all veterans, you know, with Donald Trump saying that the mere act of athletes kneeling during the national anthem means you've insulted every veteran who ever served in war. With that atmosphere, how important is it for non-veterans and veterans on college campuses to form bonds, to talk to one another, to discuss what the experiences of these vets might be in wars and how wars might be seen by non-vets at home?
I think that's one of the most important things. That is one of the most important and most accessible strategies that we can use. We can talk to each other. We can ask questions. It was interesting that I went to these trainings for faculty about how to teach veterans as if there has to be some kind of secret code to be able to relate to veterans, as if they aren't human beings and students. Right. But anyway, so I would go to these conferences about how to teach veterans, and we would get a list of questions not to ask veterans, a list of questions to avoid asking veterans.
Wow.
And some of the questions on the list were patently absurd and conveyed an ideological valence. Like one of the questions was, are you crazy like the Vietnam vets? Now, I guarantee you no person will ask a veteran that question, but it was put on the list for a reason. I mean, it performs ideological work, right? It performs this work of making faculty against veterans, I mean, seemingly against veterans. So that was on the list. But one of the questions on the list was, what do you think of the wars? Now, that is very troubling. That tells faculty that one should not ask veterans about their opinions of the wars, that this might somehow damage the veterans. And I found the opposite with veterans. Not all veterans wanted to talk about the wars, but many did. And they had opinions about it. And many felt that their experience was erased on college campuses. Like, this was the most formative experience. They had some of the worst experiences, and also, honestly, some of their best experiences in terms of camaraderie and feeling their own strength. I mean, it was a very mixed bag, but it was formative for these students. And the fact that apparently nobody wanted to talk about it, and I don't think that nobody wants to talk about it. I think people are afraid to talk about it because they've been told not to talk about it. And I think to break down that silence, to break down that wall, is in everybody's interest, certainly in the interest of the veterans, certainly.
Well, Ellen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website where people can find out more about your work.
That's right. It's ellen-moore.com.
We'll post a link to that from our site. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali. Have a good day.
Ellen Moore is a fellow at the Slow Science Institute, visiting scholar at the Institute for the Study of Societal Issues at the University of California. She works as a social worker for recent immigrants. We've been discussing her new book, Grateful Nation, Student Veterans and the Rise of the Military-Friendly Campus. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find out more about our program on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.